From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Thank you, Laurie Burt, for supporting me and this podcast by making a pledge at my Patreon page. Do you want to hear your name here at the top of the show? Are you enjoying this podcast and would like to help me make more episodes? Then head over to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It means a great deal to me and you will get to headline the show just like Laurie did today. Thank you for tuning in to episode number 118. This week is the turn of extraordinary man Rafi Sotoli. I connected with Rafi via a friend request and we got chatting. True to form, I said he should come on the podcast and here we are. Rafael Sotoli has an MSc in molecular biology and is a PhD candidate in health sciences at the Behavioral and Molecular Lab in Portugal. His understanding of metabolism, nutrition and clinical medicine all goes into the Nutrita app he built with his team. He loves open scientific debate, CrossFit, football, hiking and cold water immersion. You can find out more about Rafi's app at nutrita.app and try it for free for 7 days. Should you wish to keep using it, you can get 20% off a monthly or annual subscription by using the code KWP20. This is the first part of our conversation, and Rafi talks about his app, the muddy waters of observational data, and the fascinating research he is doing for his PhD. Make sure to tune in next week for part two when he talks more about those cold showers. Welcome, Rafi, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Daisy. Thank you very much for having me on.
It's one of those rare times when we're both in the same time zone. I'm usually recording with people in a very different time zone, but we're actually on the same line.
It really makes life easier, doesn't it?
It does. It really does. We've kind of crossed paths before, but this is the first time we've met. You've been telling me a little bit about yourself before we start recording. So why don't you go on to tell us about you?
Yeah, well, we were talking about what we're doing in the world of nutrition, basically, and how we came at it. And we were just basically thinking how far back it went in each of our cases. I think you said about 4 or 5 years for you that you've been sort of woke to the keto diet, as one might say. And for myself, I think it must go back to about 2009. Yeah, 2009, 2010. When I was really starting to pay attention to nutrition and what it could mean for health and how the history of nutrition really developed, because that was my entree into all of this through Gary Taubes' book, which takes a really historical perspective when he's making his argument about the causes of obesity. And this was really, you know, revelatory to me, and it really put me onto a path of discovery and trying to, you know, experiment with myself and go into scientific research and do some larger scale non-personal experiments for a change and you know, work on some cells or some rats and really start to look at aspects of metabolism. And in getting there, I've also co-founded a company with a very good friend of mine, where we try to give people some what we think is basic health advice, which really centers around nutrition. And that's why we created Nutrita Pro, which is our app where people can, you know, log foods and basically get an idea of whether these foods are nutritious, what it's doing to their insulin levels, and thus how it's predisposing them to a good or bad diet, you know, depending on these sort of indirect measures that not really many other apps have. So we thought it was worth putting out there for that reason, in large part.
Yes, tell me a bit more about that, because it sounds really interesting. How does it work?
Yeah.
Explain what would happen for me as a user. How would it work?
So basically, you'd arrive on the homepage of our website, and you can see right away that we're about helping you reach your goals. And these goals are pretty typical. It could be losing a couple of kilos. It could be lowering your blood sugars. It could be, you know, decreasing inflammation, whether that's something you feel in your joints or you can measure on a lab test. So these sort of, you know, really important health goals, basically, that tell us if we're going in the right direction. So you get on the website and then you log in and sign up to the app and you try it for free. And basically what you'd come across is a high quality database where you could look up foods and you can just track them. And instead of just being given the typical, you know, these are your calories and restrict them by X percent to lose that many kilos of weight. I mean, it rarely works like this, and in the real world, when you're outside of a metabolic chamber. So that's not the approach we're taking. We're focusing more on, you know, food quality and sort of, you know, what we take to be some important physiological responses, which is just a fancy way of saying how your body responds to the food. So, you know, you would be confronted with the insulin load, which is a measure many people have never heard of, but it's pretty important when considering sort of how do I want to construct my diet? Because we all have ideas of, you know, what's good for us. And I think it helps to have some objective measures for diet. They're very hard to create, to be honest, for many reasons, but we think we have a good one here with our keto score, our insulin index, insulin load, and, you know, our nutrient density score, which is sort of my baby. It's something that I was really interested in developing and did it with our team, because it really takes a, you know, a team effort to do it. It's much too complex for someone like me who doesn't know programming and many other aspects that go into building something like that.
Yes, it sounds like a lot of work. My brother-in-law is a website designer, app developer, all these things. And yeah, so I've had a bit of an insight into just how much work is involved in producing an app. It's incredible amount of work.
Yeah, it's probably, I've never written a book, but I hear that writing a book is not too far off that. Those sort of all-consuming projects you have to really dive into to produce something worthwhile.
Absolutely. And so you said you started getting interested in nutrition from a personal point of view, but why was that? Did you have health issues, or it was just a natural development of where you were going? You just naturally got interested in it.
It's hard to say. I would say that the sort of change happened from being sort of disillusioned by studies of, I was doing a management degree in London. And it was pretty uninspiring to me. And I was much more interested in, you know, watching physics lectures on YouTube and reading about, you know, an article on sports science or something like that. And it really was sort of rekindling an interest in science that I think I clearly remember having in childhood, sort of lost it during my adolescence and then just started craving it, as a student. Mm-hmm. And that really just, it showed me that I had to really change direction. And then sort of nutrition was sort of, I guess, it was lucky in the sense that I came across Gary Taubes' book. I can't even remember how. And then I put it down the first time because I couldn't get through it. It was too dense. And for some reason, it didn't catch. And I think 2-3 months later, I picked it up again. And then for whatever reason, it's stuck. And it was pretty convincing. And it led me down many, many different, you know, avenues. So I just start picking up textbooks in biology to understand things he was explaining. And that's also when I started using Twitter and started to use PubMed and all of these different resources. That led me to really appreciate the richness of nutrition because it's history, it's culture, it's religion for the good and the bad sides. Mm. It's also some really complex science. So for me, it had everything.
It opened up a whole load of rabbit holes,
oh, yeah.
A bit.
Yeah, and it allowed me to meet interesting people and you know, make what I would think is a productive use of Twitter to ask smarter people than you some really good questions. So, you know, I love the tool for that reason, however vitriolic it can get.
Yes, absolutely. You were telling me earlier that you're working on your PhD. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so my PhD is on the metabolic side effects that you can suffer from when you take antipsychotics. And I'm studying that in a rat model. So I'm using rats. And those particular rats have schizophrenia. In a sense, we induce what the closest thing that we imagine to be schizophrenia in a rat, right. Which is, of course, as you can imagine, a very limited model. But nonetheless, we do our best to see, you know, what these antipsychotics do to their behavior and what is the nature of the side effects that it has on metabolism. Because as many people know, unfortunately, when you take antipsychotics, people can gain weight, people can have disordered blood sugars. So not only is dealing with the mental health issue very difficult in and of itself, but then you also have just the additional side effects from the drugs that can be pretty significant to the point where people have to keep switching drugs. And they often get into a merry-go-round of drug switching. And in truth, there's not very good science on who's going to respond well to which drug. As much as that's touted, unfortunately, it doesn't appear to be that way to me. It seems very much, let's throw things on the wall and see what sticks, you know, and try to do it in a conservative manner, taking care of dose and taking care of some aspects of timing. But really, we don't have a very good solution when it comes to antipsychotics and mental health thereof. I think their effectiveness is sort of limited and debatable, depending on which studies you look at. And so the interest for me was really trying to bring in the ketogenic diet to this study of metabolism side effects, because I had initially started out learning about anecdotes about people on bipolar and schizophrenia getting better from fasting or ketogenic diet, or I think there was even aspects of intense exertion, which can of course put people into a temporary state of low glycogen availability.
Oh,
and that being associated with improvements in very temporary improvements in mental health. And this kept pointing to a possible effect of the ketogenic diet. So that's why in my experiments, I put some of my rats on a ketogenic diet just to see, do the antipsychotics have the same effects on their weight, depending on which dietary context they're in? So these are sort of questions I wanted to explore in my PhD. That led me into a PhD in neuroscience, actually, because I'm looking at the brain as well. But I do come at it from a nutrition paradigm. So I have that opportunity to be working in that sector. And it's been pretty interesting. The life of someone who works in a lab isn't very glamorous, I have to say. But it certainly can be very, very interesting.
Wow, that is a very interesting subject indeed. What made you choose it?
Well, in truth, it was a situation where beggars can't be choosers. And I was actually looking for lab experience, not a PhD in particular. And then this PhD presented itself. And I wasn't looking for neuroscience, but it appeared it was still very interesting to me. but it was a study of metabolism to some extent. And that is fundamentally the level at which I tend to approach questions of health. At least it's my starting point, I should say. I love learning new things in science. I'm not someone who can only stick to one subject and do that for 10 years straight. I do like to enjoy a larger picture if I can. And yeah, so it seemed to fit getting lab experience and really investigating these important questions and hopefully, you know, providing some insight into what it can mean for people. So although I work in rats, you know, it's really an opportunity to get to know researchers and who are working in the field, and also people who actually suffer from a mental health issue that we would, you know, diagnose sort of thing, and really ask them how it is for them, because it's actually very, very difficult to study those sort of effects in rats. You know, how do you actually feel? Because that is, of course, the quality of life that we all seek. So I think even if you're studying it in rats, you have to stay grounded in a sense and keep speaking with people who are suffering from the disease and look at the very rare times where these things resolve. They're very rare and we should pay attention to them. Even if we might never find the explanation, they will at least provide some level of clues, I think. And so those anecdotes were really, really interesting to me.
And it's the problem, like you were saying before, these medications often don't necessarily work very well, or certainly don't work as well as intended, but you get all these side effects, and that really comes back to, doesn't it, that quality of life. Mm-hmm. And if they're really threatening that quality of life and working a bit, maybe you can see why people just don't want to take them.
Yeah, and it's very difficult for me to, I mean, don't get me wrong, if you can take a pill and it can improve your quality of life with some acceptable degree of side effects, go for it.
Absolutely.
I'm by no means, you know, a purist in that regard where you have to cure yourself by any natural remedy. I really don't care. In a very basic sense, what's effective, what works, what's cheap, what has some, let's say, some backing. And when I mean backing, I mean things like, does it make sense from an evolutionary perspective? So if we're looking at, you know, causes of disease and these sort of things, you know, we have to take that lens. So I was very much interested in when actually the first reports of schizophrenia emerged. And this is not, I mean, you're not going to be able to find traces of schizophrenia in a caveman, obviously, but you can find suggestions of those sort of conditions arising, you know, maybe when you started having recorded history. And of course, it's very hard to distinguish between bipolar and schizophrenia. And some would argue there's not even a meaningful distinction to make. But I think it was interesting to learn about a hypothesis that suggested that schizophrenia, the disease, was only made possible once our brains develop to where they could sort of have this very creative, artistic, even tendency for the spiritual and the religious. When these things started to emerge in our species, it suggested that that's when schizophrenia essentially might have been sort of a statistical outgrowth nearly. Basically, yeah, when that new aspect of yourself exists and it goes wrong, this is how it tends to go wrong. And it's always interesting to consider, you know, when things emerge, because it gives you hints as to the brain structures where, the process is about, which might underlie this emergence of this weird, you know, behavioral state people find themselves in, and a conceptual state where you can't think of things normally. And why is everything else seeming to work in your body, but the most basic thing of your moment to moment experience of yourself is completely different? There's much more I could say about that, but this was an interesting hypothesis to start with. And it led me down the road of, you know, looking at other aspects of schizophrenia, which we can go into. But the long and short of it is that it brings back to a very basic metabolic defect somewhere in the brain at some level that is influenced by our overall energy state. Because how can we explain these emerging anecdotes of people getting better really when their fundamental energy state is being changed, whether that's fasting? We know we've known it from, you know, religion, where fasts have induced temporary sort of cures for epilepsy, another phenomenon that's, you know, arising in the brain and having to do with the energy state. So we have a lot of hints, actually. You know, it's maybe no surprise that if ketogenic diet is so effective in epilepsy, is it so crazy to think it could affect another part of the brain, which affects these other sort of processes? And I think the researchers should wake up to that fact. And then when I mean researchers, I mean the wider world of research, because when we're doing so poorly in terms of providing ideas as to how diseases emerge and how we should construct drugs or therapies to treat that, I think we have to go back to some very fundamental assumptions. And, you know, we have to insert the idea of mismatch, that we're in a mismatched environment and diet is part of that. And I think this gets to the heart of not just schizophrenia and bipolar and mental health. This gets to the heart of, you know, obesity and depression and all sorts of, and diabetes and so on and so forth. So that's my, why I can find a totally new subject interesting, because it's subsumed also by that aspect of shared pathology, basically.
Yes, and it makes total sense to just to try and get back to every time what the root cause is. And I like that, where you look at it with that evolutionary lens, because that helps, doesn't it? Get back to trying to find these clues, trying to piece it together when it first came about. And like you were saying, just linking these different diseases and different states of being that all seem to be connected and all seem to be impacted by what we eat. And it just seems obvious that something so, well, I say so easy, it's not always so easy, is it, to change your diet, change your lifestyle? But something potentially so easy should be that sort of first line of defense before you start throwing these medications at it that don't necessarily work very well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we can say the same thing for diabetes and obesity.
Absolutely.
And it's both encouraging in the sense that if we can get this one framework right and start having people appreciate this way of approaching questions of health and science, I think it could, you know, it could have a domino effect in that sense. Because it's not just in nutrition, like we were saying, it's in mental health. It's not even just in mental health. It's in, you know, sports science and how we get, elderly people to, well, or how we fail to get elderly people strong again, for example. We don't understand this question of mismatch very fundamentally, or even I would say why we're still debating statins to this day. Let's admit that a big part of that conversation is not understanding the use of a constituent part of our physiology and simply thinking it's something that the lower is the better. And it's a very, I think it's a problem in thought that it just underlies so many different aspects of the conversation.
Yes, and these such long held assumptions of things that they just are that way, that are just based on things that are so fragile, studies and things that are so fragile in the first place. It's only when you start unpicking them. But they're so much part of our psyche, you know, that fat is bad and that LDL is bad and all these things. And so it's really difficult, isn't it, to start breaking that down and building up what is a much better solution. But I think finding a better way, an easier way to treat something like schizophrenia that completely takes over somebody's life. I mean, coming up with a possible fairly easy solution to at least help with that is going to impact so many people monumentally.
Yeah, I would urge people to take a look at Chris Palmer's work. He's a doctor I came to know about and I got in contact with him, and he's writing up some very interesting case reports, and he has several of these people now who have really put their mental health issue into remission or are even off meds to a large extent. And it's incredible to see how closely he can tie diet to it, because of course, you know, these people have gone on and off of them. And you can, again, if you repeatedly do that and you keep seeing the same pattern, it gets better in one state and worse in the other. It's not a randomized controlled trial, but for that person, it's a very high level of evidence. That's what clinical medicine is good for. So when on the research side, we're failing to come up with convincing, you know, hypotheses, let's really pay attention to those things, because they're much better evidence than we have than a failed hypothesis. So I think it's a part of what I really want to be able to do is bridge the world of research and the clinic and get the much, much, they really should, I'm nearly saying it literally, that they should be sharing office space nearly. I mean, it's really that level of interaction that people need, you know, in an ideal world. And in a sense, that's, that's what we've been trying to do with Nutrita, where, we try to be as, you know, consumer friendly as possible and to make things simple and, you know, really make it user friendly. But in the end, we are giving you very advanced concepts for what is the world of nutrition. The importance of the insulin load is not appreciated by the vast majority of doctors and researchers and dietitians and health coaches out there. It's just an unfortunate fact. Yet it might be one of the most important measures you can track if you're going to track, if you need that help and you need that support. So it's an interesting, you know, challenge to try to bridge that knowledge gap for people, because it's not, you know, it's not good enough to say, yeah, we're not going to bother you with, you know, obsessively tracking calories. You have to give something in return. You can't just take things away. You have to have good substitutes. And that's what we try to do with the information diet we feed people in the app. And, you know, what people do with their diet, they make the next best choice really when they can. And that's why people progress from one diet to the other often. They have to find their level playing field.
Mm-hmm. And have you found that you can get those kind of people interested, the doctors, the health coaches, so that you can use that app as a good way to bridge that gap mm-hmm. that often seems to exist when people go to their doctors who aren't on board with them doing keto?
Yeah, I've in my own life, so the doctors I've personally gone to see, they might as well be on the other side of the planet mm-hmm. when I'm talking to them about those things. They're just, it's not even in their, you know, thought process. A lot of the doctors I interact with on Twitter, like every single one would pretty much agree that, you know, some sort of telemedicine or some sort of continuous remote care of some sort, it makes total sense. And it's essentially how things are going to evolve in one form or the other. So that's the approach I take to it. So yeah, there is an interest, definitely. And those doctors who are more forward looking, definitely, you know, want to take advantage of that. And that's why we're always, you know, discussing how it can fit their needs as well, of course, because they're like, oh, that's good. I might not have to repeat myself for the 100th time in my in my practice if I have to, you know, if people have some sort of external support, because, you know, it's, you could use the same analogy for the gym. It's not what you do in the hour day at the gym. It's also what you do the rest of the day. You know, how are you sitting? Are you walking? Do you have a non-sedentary lifestyle? Right. So, it really comes down to do something to the point where it becomes a habit. And that's really hard to, I think that's the hard step for everyone is making things into a habit or undoing bad habits. Of course,
yeah, very so.
Yeah. They take a long time to stick, but when they stick, they tend to be really, really sticky.
Yes. I've been reading or rather listening to a book that's talking about that specifically, and it talks about just making these little changes and making them as easy as possible so that you will do them every day. And it's those little things that end up making big changes, and like you say, just making new habits.
Yeah. And you know, I think people have to be goal oriented, and that's why, you know, when people are onboarded onto our app, they have some very basic goals, like, you know, building muscle, controlling your blood sugar, losing fat. These sort of goals, I think people should have in mind, because it's a question of being sort of honest and have a realistic outlook about where you're at. Some of us need to gain muscle. Some of us really need to focus on losing fat. We all need to achieve a good body composition, of course, which is a good balance of both, but we start from different points. And it's good to have, like you say, some smaller goals, which you can sort of achieve realistically, to reach what you might not have guessed you could maybe 6 months ago or a year ago. And I think that's something about our psychology that's becoming clearer and clearer, that we really need to adapt to how we are in that sense and be honest with ourselves. A big goal can be encouraging, but I think it has to be, you know, divided up, you know, divided into portions.
Manageable chunks.
Yeah. And I'm saying that as someone who tends to go 100% right from the get-go. So, but the truth is, I've never struggled with being overweight. I mean, I've had to put some effort into improving my body composition, which from my side was really just putting on muscle and starting not to be sedentary and eating better. But for other people, it's no losing 10 kilos or something, or 30 pounds or whatever it is. And that's quite difficult, I think. You know, I've really tried to understand from most people that it's been really challenging, because of course, every time you fail, there's some sort of difficulty in trying for the, I don't know, 10th time for some people I've heard. I mean, it's really discouraging. So I think if people understand that actually losing weight fast is not a bad thing, as they've often been scared off of that, strangely enough, but actually it's fine to lose weight fast. Fasting is an option. Gosh, we can admit that now. You know, your brain doesn't need 150 grams of dietary carbohydrates a day. You know, you can produce the glucose yourself. Just these basic things people need to make it easier on themselves when trying to achieve their goals. And that's why we wanted to make the app goal-oriented again. It's I think we all need that. Even if that's maintaining your weight, that's fine. And that could just be, you know, just some light body weight work and just keeping on your diet. But even that's still a goal, you know, keep that in mind.
Of course. And these things change over time as well, especially as you're changing. But I like the fact that, yeah, you think about the individual and tailoring it for them, because it's all completely different, isn't it, from one person to another, what their goals might be. But then even if they have the same goals, exactly how they're going to get there, the steps they're going to have to take are going to be different depending on them. And you mentioned before, you talked about this guy, Chris Palmer, and the work that he's doing. And you touched on something there that I was discussing with Amber. And when we were talking before we started recording, you mentioned some of your pet peeves. And so I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are, what your opinion is about. You listed one of your pet peeves as the muddled conversation around observational studies. And I had a very interesting chat with Amber about that. I'd like to hear what your take is on it.
Epidemiology really has a bad rap, and deservedly so. But I think people are, I think it's more a question of not understanding which tool to use for which job. What you're doing when you're reading dozens and dozens of anecdotes online, you're doing a very, very, very small sampling of the population, essentially. And epidemiological studies are larger samples, of course. But what you can do and what the epidemiological study can do is control the variables. As much as you might try and you might present with some very complicated statistics, you can't really control the variables allowing you to infer causality. You say this happened because of that. This method of just looking at what happens at the level of population is great for generating ideas and hypotheses and disconfirming maybe some precedent, you know, some older ideas you may have. So no one is going to ignore epidemiology. As much as we criticize it, we all look at it, we all consider it. It's all part of our thinking. It's just how even our brain works. We make a lot of correlations even without, you know, making them explicitly. Our brain just does that. So we're not getting rid of it, but we really, really, really have to get sort of real with the expectations we have from it and how we sort of casually, you know, might. It's hard because sometimes we're not even specific enough when we're talking about an observational study or a scientific experiment, which are, of course, very different things. And I think this is really difficult at the level of research. You know, researchers have to think about this a lot. But I think it's also very difficult for the sort of layperson who has to deal with news headlines. And if I could have a, if I had a magic wand and one of the things people would be taught would be some basic statistics. And maybe even more importantly, some very basic fallacies that I would have Nick Mailer teach to everyone who signs up to Twitter. You have to go through 10 slides and learn about your logical fallacies and agree correlation is not causation, and then click privacy policy and all that. Then you can use Twitter. So yeah, it just makes everyone's life easier. And it's good to, I'll give everyone a very, very quick tip. Don't make your argument based on a correlational finding to support your idea, but make your argument from one that disproves a proposed causal relationship. So use it to disprove them and sort of realize it's good for, it's kindling for the creative fire. It's not to understand really how something works, the mechanics of it, infer the truth. So I think if people just started using it that way, it would make their lives easier as well, I think. They'd be less tricked into some false beliefs.
Yes, it's difficult, isn't it? And you can come at it from different directions. We just mentioned back there the idea that still is quite pervasive, that fat is bad, although it's starting to change, isn't it? I remember having such an interesting conversation with Nina Teicholz, who, of course, just pulled all these studies apart. The whole foundation that this general piece of advice that's given, the whole foundation that it's based on is just so shaky that it can't possibly hold it up. And so, yes, absolutely right that you can't make this sweeping, generalized piece of advice based on those studies. But the interesting conversation that I was having with Amber was coming back at it from a different way of saying you can't necessarily tell an individual you should feel this way or your body should behave this way because I have a scientific study to prove it. That's when it becomes important. Your own observational study of what happens with your own body.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing. I could go sort of round and round in circles where you can say doesn't work well for one thing, but you know, I want to use it as a strong reason when I'm talking about myself.
Yeah. No, people have to, a good scientist is an observant scientist. I mean, they have to be paying attention to what's going on around them. And the scientific experiment is just doing that to a very, very rigorous level. And an observational study is doing that at the level of rigor that's possible, really, when you're looking at large numbers and a larger, you know, number of people. So yeah, it's understanding that I will not call it a pyramid because I hate the evidence pyramid. It's usually nonsense. If you type evidence pyramid into Google and look at pictures, it's really not a good guide. But yeah, the conversation is very muddled. I just see it every day. It's funny. It's one of those things where you could look at people's, three-letter acronyms after their names and assume that they would not make the mistakes. But they really are as pervasive amongst the very educated people, I would say. They really do seem, it's one of those things where, yeah, it's hard to eradicate in one's mind. I think you can only do it temporarily at best when really making an effort.
Like you say, I think muddled conversation is a very good description of it.
Yeah.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowomen. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Conor McGregor. What defines us is how well we rise after falling. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.